This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Box office top 10. Like this at 10. Sicko.
Because I didn't get to do this last week because James was here.
James spoke very well for you.
Did he?
Really, I think. Yeah.
Of me or for me?
Well, no, he kind of said pretty much what I imagine you might say, which was the stuff about the American Health Service would make you mad about the state of the American Health Service, but the inaccuracies about the way
the British Health
our good friend Mr. Moore describes the British Health Service would also make you mad.
I mean, it's funny. I saw it in Cannes, and I think everybody who comes from a country in which there is a health service sort of felt this sort of swell of pride because the American system is so completely bankrupt and so totally iniquitous that you think, of course, one ought to have decent healthcare. But then, you know, he comes to England, and literally, it's the portrait that he paints is one of Brigadoon. You know, if you have a cough. You're immediately whisked in a Rolls Royce to an incredibly clean hospital where you're seen by doctors earning £400,000 a year and all driving Bentleys. Who've all got plenty of spare time and they're just coming in to attend to you. Then they get you, they make you right. You don't get any MRSA or anything. And on the way out, they give you a wad of cash and pat you on
the back. Does that not happen to you?
Well, I don't know. Maybe that hasn't come down to the South yet. But it's the interesting Michael Moore thing, which is that when Michael Moore talks about things that one doesn't know about, you think, well, he must maybe skim this. I don't know. Well, let's see how it goes. The minute he talks about anything you do have first-hand experience of, you realise how much he's making it up or how much he's skimming. And I think the basic proposition of the film, of course, is correct. Health service, good. Lack of health service, not good. But it's just demonstrative that when he comes here, you go, hold on a moment, that's not anything like what we're experiencing here. And of course, and it's the same when he's referring presumably to other places in Europe and to Canada. It's exactly the same issue. He has a habit of taking a complex situation and simplifying it to the point of it maybe not actually being true anymore. But it's a better film than Fahrenheit 9/11.
At number 9 is The Seeker. The Dark is Rising.
Yeah, and it isn't. Apparently, I haven't read
it's
the book.
What? It's not rising?
The Dark is not rising. It's sort of seeping. And it's one of those things. When at the beginning of it, I was thinking it's an interesting film in here and there's interesting storylines and it just doesn't come together. But apparently, you know, there is more going on in the source.
More going on in the source?
Yes.
What, the source of the novel or the
The novel, yeah.
Okay. We haven't got time to go further into that. Run, Fat Boy, Run, still hanging on in at number 8.
Yeah, it's done much better than I expected, so who knew?
But what
I
do still, you know?
Yeah, exactly, what do I know?
At 7, Resident Evil Extinction.
I mean, it is the end of the series, one would hope, but I'm sure it isn't because I'm sure there's still money in that franchise. I mean, it's all visual flash, but nothing of any substance.
The Heartbreak Kid is at number 6.
Which, maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just me.
Quite likely.
Have you seen it?
No.
No. Well, it was just me in that case. I don't think it's funny. I don't think it's anything like as funny as it ought to be, and I think it's slightly creepy.
Rendition at 5.
This isn't my line. Somebody else said rendition, not as extraordinary as it ought to be. And actually, that is complete. No, it's completely right. It's an interesting story, and it's obviously politically very apposite at the moment. And yet, somehow, you get the feeling that what you're seeing is tilting much too much towards melodrama, when in fact, just the simple nuts and bolts of the story itself would have worked. I mean, we are in this strange period at the moment. It's like the post-Vietnam movies. We're now getting the post-War on Terror movies. And there are a lot of them. There's Robert Redford's Lions for Lambs coming up. There's the Brian De Palma Redacted coming up. I just didn't think that it was as extraordinary as its subject matter.
Eastern Promises are number 4.
And what did James say I would have said?
He didn't like it as much as you, I don't think.
Really?
I can't remember. Don't think so.
I thought it was great. I really liked it. Now, one reservation may be that if I put it next to History of Violence, which I think it's a companion piece, incidentally, do I think it's every bit as good as History of Violence? Maybe not. Maybe not. But it's a minor, minor thing. I think Viggo Mortensen is absolutely fantastic. I think the male wrestling with knives naked in the bathhouse sequence is up there with the naked wrestling in Women in Love, and I'm all for that, obviously. And I think, as always with Cronenberg...
Is there any naked wrestling that you've disapproved of?
Well, I didn't like it in Borat, but I don't like Borat very much. But, I mean, I felt the moment in Borat when they naked wrestled was the point at which they'd run out of ideas, so it's let's do some naked wrestling, because if everything else fails, that'll passingly entertain the audience. In Eastern Promises, that scene is just monumental. I mean, people are already referring to it like the shower scene from Psycho. It's the bathhouse scene from Eastern Promises. And yet there's so much else in the film as well. As with all of Cronenberg's movies, it's his movie is something other than just the script.
John in Bath, saw Eastern Promises yesterday. If nothing else, it should win an award for being the only film set in London not to feature the London Eye or the Gherkin. It was an afternoon showing with only 9 people in the audience, but still there were loud gasps of horror during the bathhouse scene.
Great stuff,
and preferred this even to The Good Doctor's Favourite History of Violence.
Oh, really? Well, okay, fine.
So did I have nightmares afterwards about having my typing abilities repeatedly decimated by an angry pliers-bearing Russian? No. I had a dream about an irritating rat, most likely brought on by seeing the Ratatouille, and that's how he's written it, based anti-piracy advert again. This is a film I've already forked out £7 to be underwhelmed by, and I'm now being preached at by the star rodent, who's clearly never seen a pirated DVD, telling me I should go to the cinema to see films, despite me having been to the cinema to see this. He's crosses, John. Stardust at 3.
How'd you say, John? You know, he can't hear you. The rat, it's
made up.
It's filmed, yes, I'm sorry. Stardust, it's fine. It's a little bit hokey around the edges, but it's good-hearted, and I think kids will enjoy it. And it's very much, although obviously it's American finance and everything, it is very much a British fantasy movie and rather well-written. A bit messy around the edges, but not necessarily bad for that. It's nothing like as good as Time Bandit.
The Mayo family observation was quite close to Princess Bride in terms of spirit.
I think it aspires to being like Princess Bride. I actually think Princess Bride is one of the best children's movies.
Best
children's movies, certainly. I mean, I love that film. I don't think this is in the same, quite the same league. But I don't mean that as a really harsh criticism, because I think Princess Bride is extraordinary in the same way that Time Bandit is extraordinary. I think this isn't extraordinary, but it is fine, and it's quite charming.
Saw 4 at 2.
Yeah, I had to pay to go and see it, and then just felt like I just wasted my money, because it's just all the other Saw films. I mean, you know, there's death at the beginning, and the tape comes out of the dead body, and then it starts all over again. When are they going to stop? Please stop. But then, of course, it took a bunch of money.
Ratatouille is the UK's number one movie.
You know, I've seen it again since I reviewed it before, because I had to go.
Were you wrong?
No, I mean, second time round, I suppose. No, second time round, I saw more things in it. And, of course, I have in the back of my mind that, you know, as I said, somebody from the company wrote me a thing saying, look, whatever you think of it, they don't market test these movies, and I'm willing to take that on board. I did laugh a little bit more the second time. I still think it's too long. I still think it's largely not a great narrative storytelling. Of course, second time you see it, there's lots more detail that catches your eye. I still don't think it's classic, but, you know, hey, the kids like it.
We'll do our review sequence, which is what we're here to do. Is it Elizabeth first?
Well, we could do Elizabeth the First first. Well, I wanted to do 30 Days of Night first.
Okay, in which case we'll do 30 Days of Night with old Josh Hartnett.
30 Days of Night, a modern vampire movie set in Alaska. Deal is, sun's going down, and it's going to be down for 30 Days of Night. You see, because it's...
I worked that one out.
Thank you. And so the town is shutting up shop, but somebody, a stranger, comes in, cuts the power, does some bad stuff, misbehaves in a bar, a cafe, ends up in prison, warning of bad things to come. And warning of these bad things to come in a very peculiar accent.
So sweet. So helpless against what is coming.
It's just trying to freak us out.
It's working. We have more important things to think about. I'll check on Gus.
Check on Gus. Bar the windows. Try to hide. They're coming. This time they're going to take me with them. Honor me. Yeah. For all that I have done.
They? Who are they?
It can't be that scary. You just want to laugh.
No, but it's funny, because I've actually, ever since I heard that, I've been trying to do that voice. I can't do it. Got all of them. Anyway, so it's directed by David Slade, a British filmmaker. I think he's from Sheffield originally, who made Hard Candy, which I just thought was terrific.
I remember you going on at great length.
Which is a real leg crosser of a movie, and it's good because it, you know, turns the table on the male members of the audience, and no pun intended. And it's really,
it's
really.
Thing
no,
say.
I didn't mean that. I didn't, but it is really, really sort of cutting edge and, you know, scalpel like. And it's a clearly sort of authorial work, and it's got a very clear thesis, and it's a. You know, it's a horror movie, and it's a thriller, and it's also an argument, and I really liked it. Now, this is a much more mainstream film, and for a start, it cost a lot more. It cost, you know, $30-odd million. It very briefly went to number one in America, and it has yet to make its money back. I think it will do. But it is clearly a mainstream modern vampire movie, in the, I suppose, in the same ilk to some extent as Near Dark. The idea of The Night coming down and lasting for a month isn't completely original. It was a film a while ago, I think it was a Swedish movie or maybe German, called Frostbite, which again had the same idea that has recurred before in the horror genre. So you get this thing in which there's a long period the vampires can come out to play for as long as they want. That, you know, because obviously the sun's not coming up. On the downside, I think you don't get the sense that the cast are there for the whole 30 days of Night. I think it looks like there is some material missing. It looks like there's been some rewriting done. It doesn't completely hang together as a totally coherent piece of writing, and it doesn't have, I think, the depth of Hard Candy. On the positive side, I think he's a very stylish director. When it needs to be nasty, it is nasty. There are a good few jumps in it. Some of the characterization is a little bit two-dimensional, but Danny Houston does a great job of playing the lead vampire, and they speak in this kind of strange Slavic clicking, and which I found very entertaining, because I like the idea that somebody's actually figured out, you know, a whole vampire dialect. They did that rather well. But the thing I liked most about it was that it is a full-on blood and guts horror movie when it needs to be. I don't think it's a masterpiece. I think that it's the best you can say about it is that he is an interesting director and he will continue to do interesting work. It's probably, you know, a good Halloween season shocker. It'd be scare you, but then you're a complete sissy.
Yeah, I wouldn't go and see it.
But why? No, you might enjoy a, you know, vampire movie.
What certificate is it?
15. Yeah, but, you know, okay. But 15 now, you have to understand that when I was a kid, because 15 now, there's stuff past 15 now that when I was a kid, you know, the Daily Mail was campaigning against, was saying it was going to bring around the end of civilization. As long as it doesn't include sexual violence, you can pretty much do whatever you like at 15.
I don't like people getting skinned. That's the thing. If a movie starts with that, I think, oh, I don't want this.
No, it's a vampire movie, so there is a little bit of, you know, skin, muscle interface relaxing. But, you know, but I do think it's stylishly done. I like the idea. It's got a nice end. Ending to it sort of ties itself up nicely. I don't think it's
a happy ending, is it?
It's got and this is what so few good horror movies have. It has a proper ending.
What's a proper?
I can't tell you what it is because it ties itself together without sort of selling out. It has a proper ending. It's not perfect, and there are things about it that are disappointing and disjunctive and messy.
So it's a proper ending the way a great music track would finish properly, like Won't Get Fooled Again has got a proper ending.
Exactly, yeah.
As opposed to a disappointing fade, which is like pointless.
Yeah, like all those Madonna records, which just go...
Nick, brilliant impression there, Nick. And people can watch that, of course, as you're streamed.
Can YouTube it.
Nick, I've seen 30 Days of Night. I'm also a vampire fan. However, 30 Days of Night is slow, disjointed, overhyped, tat, Josh's worst film ever by a mile. Rob in Bristol saw 30 Days of Night, fantastic film with best vampires since the original Salem's Lot. Keith, I'm watching you both live in pictures on my computer. Why? I have no idea. To think they used to use this kind of technology to send men to the moon, now they use it to send men to my desktop. Jimmy in Plymouth, the top of the gherkin
service there
was visible in one shot in Eastern Prime.
The gherkin was okay.
Naomi Watts rides her motorbike over a bridge, and we can see it in that. This is when you say hello to David Morrissey.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, David Morrissey. Could you add and hello from his builder Will too?
Okay.
So I'm not sure we can start adding Dave's domestic staff.
Since we're doing this, can I say hello to Tony and Simon, who came all the way from Nottingham to Hampshire yesterday for reasons best known only to themselves?
No, I don't think so. Okay. So hello to any of this week's movies would be improved by having David Morrissey or Jason Isaacs?
Most of them, generally. Most of them would be. You know, it's a corking pairing, and there are very few movies that would suffer from having either of those two in them.
One of the movies out this weekend, Elizabeth, The Golden Age.
Or Elizabeth Part Deux.
Yeah, the Americans would call it Elizabeth II, wouldn't they?
Probably, but they'll think it's about Queen Elizabeth II.
Just before you pronounce, John in Glasgow says, "Dear Dr. K, because you're now part of Simon Mayo, so
I am.
All correspondence to you comes to me."
Sprout boy.
Elizabeth, the Golden Age, or Elizabeth II, which could prove very confusing, is great. It's a romp through the glory days of merry old England under threat from the despicable Johnny Foreigner types. Every Spaniard is amazingly ugly, and Philip is barking mad to boot. Cate Blanchett is out-Helening Dame Helen Mirren, almost. In Scotland, Elizabeth is considered a mad, bad old cow who murdered our Queen. However, I almost cheered when she got her head chopped off. What an accent! Where in the hell did Mary, Queen of Scots, get to learn to speak like that? Her English in real life made "hello, hello" sound kosher. The battle scene when it eventually came was great. Even I cheered. Can't wait for Elizabeth III.
That's very good. I mean, it hits all the major points. Firstly, on the Helen Mirren question, it is certainly becoming the case that if you want to get an Oscar or an Oscar nomination, you know, play a royal. Because Mirren, she got you know, the Golden Globe and whatever it is for doing the Elizabeth, and then she did, then she got. She won the Oscar just recently, and Judi Dench got her Oscar for Shakespeare in Love for the shortest ever supporting role in Shakespeare in Love, in which she turns up and says, "I'm the Queen," and then leaves, and everyone says, "That's marvellous, here, have an Oscar." And didn't Cate Blanchett get nominated for doing this last time back in 1998? And presumably, it will be up again for this. Now, the first film had a degree of sobriety, although it was, you know, it was stylish and everything, but it was about intrigue and all that sort of stuff. And this film is strange because it starts off being about intrigue, being to some extent about the conflict between being a great big, you know, important international figure, but also having to deal with things on a personal level, having to deal with personal relationships. Largely, it has to be said, seen here by her fancying of Clive Owen, as, you know, he of the cape-drangling Walter Raleigh says, "Oh, yes, madam," and he turns up and it's Clive Owen and he's got a beard and he's got a bag of potatoes that he's brought back from the new one. He's got some fags, so he brings her everything that she needs. And she sort of wonders whether...
Did she say, "Didn't you used to be King Arthur?"
King Arthur?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I beg your pardon. Sorry, yes, no, she
did. Clive Owen, King Arthur. In Boom. Arthur.
Thank you. In Arthur. No, Arthur's the film with Dudley Moore. I don't think there was a King Arthur in Arthur.
Carry on.
That's got one of the best lines of about Manhattan. It says it's a very small island. Last year they had the entire island carpeted. Anyway.
Carry on.
So it starts off like that. And then it suddenly, the thing with the Spanish really, really kicks off. And the film goes mad. Here is a clip as Elizabeth is facing the threat of the Armada coming to invade.
This Spanish Armada is at sea with an army of 10,000 men, and Philip's friend, the Duke of Parma, has 15,000 men on the French coast.
They plan to cross the channel in barges and sail into the Thames.
They don't have enough barges yet, we have a little time. And our forces defend the mouth of the Thames at Tilbury with, what happened, is it 4,000 men?
3,000. Possibly.
If the Spanish fleet unites the barges, their combined strength will overwhelm us.
Then we shall engage them at sea, before they have the chance to unite.
Your Majesty, this vast armada will surely smash through our naval defences and overrun us on land. We must prepare for the worst.
This sounds terrific stuff.
Well, it's definitely, there's a lot of acting going on. There's a lot of no fixed accenting going on. That's absolutely right. And there is an awful lot of people, you know, preparing for the worst and girding them. And then what happens is, the next thing you know, she's sitting on a white horse dressed from head to foot in spangly Darth Vader style, you know, armor, looking for all the world like a cross between Boudicca and Joan of Arc, waving a sword around, doing the effectively the Mel Gibson speech from, you know, "Ah, ha, ha, here they come and we are la la la." Meanwhile, out in the sea, Clive is swinging from flaming galleon to flaming galleon on the end of a piece of rope, merrily singeing the Spanish beard before leaping and flying into the sea and swimming up under. But you just think, what? Hang on, it has turned into Pirates of the Caribbean, and it's very peculiar. I mean, it's almost like there's sort of this opening act in which it's, you know, serious, courtly, all stuff going on, all Spanish, all Catholicism, all, yes, head's going to roll, and then suddenly it's ba-dum, 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 everybody's waving flags around, and the film...
Turn into Eddie Izzard.
No, but it's just strange. And then it sort of settles down again at the end. And part of me thought, this is ridiculous. This is history as retold in the Duran Duran video. It's clearly been directed by Russell Mulcahy. You half expect Simon Le Bon to come,
no,
you know,
heaven help us.
In his blue woad. And then the other half of it is that, well, hey, there's some ripping fun to be had in that. I'm not sure that occasionally the pantomime quality doesn't actually slightly diminish the ripping fun, because you do think this is preposterous. I mean, this really, I just am ceasing to believe this. But there is something to be said for making it romp along. I think in the end it trips itself up because it is, finally, rather silly. There's a marvellous moment, the beheading moment, which is done in this sort of extraordinarily kind of prosaic way, and these red, you know, red costumes, and the axe is lifted, and it's a very, very strong moment. And it's interesting because Sheikh Kapoor, I think, excels in moments of bold imagery rather than in a totally coherent narrative. And I think it does seem like a lot of bits of movie that are kind of unbalanced and ultimately messy. But there are things in it. I mean, I know some critics have given it very poor reviews. I saw The Guardian today give it one star and said it's just ridiculous. Well, it is ridiculous. I'm not sure that's necessarily totally against it.
Ridiculous, but rather entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the leaping from galleon to galleon was laugh-out-loud funny.
Roberto in Leeds, the accent in 30 Days, which you were talking about earlier, is just like Adam Sandler in Billy Madison when he's talking to the penguins. Damien in Burnley, 30 Days of Night, Josh Hartnett's worst movie by a mile, two words, Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, oh, that's right, I'd forgotten Josh Hartnett was in Pearl Harbor.
Courtney in London, Simon and Mark, walking down the street yesterday, I was reminded of the discussion from several weeks ago about whether a movie could be predicted to be bad if it was advertised on the side of a bus. I don't agree with the bus side part of the theory, but the general gist is correct if you substitute telephone box for bus. This may be a particularly London phenomenon, but my strict policy is to avoid any movie using this advertising medium. Case in point, some dreadful-looking new movie with Chuck in the title, and London ads for that last Robin Williams movie were only put on telephone boxes. It must be a cheaper way to advertise those films than the film companies don't have much hope for. And Mark, you're completely right about that rat movie. I fell asleep and I was sitting outside in the cold at a drive-in theatre in the US.
Can I just tell
you... Anyway, if it's on a phone box, it's going to be dull.
No, unfortunately, here's the thing that completely blows a hole in that. Shaun of the Dead. Shaun of the Dead was very heavily advertised on
phone
boxes.
Box movie, was it?
It was. They had zombies pressed. It was like, so as you approach the phone box, it looked like the phone box was full of zombies.
Because that's going to make you want to go and make a call, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Well, you know, more so than the...
Makes a change from the postcard. Exactly. Is that what you're talking about? Whatever you're referring to.
Yes. Should we do a...
I think we need a Steve Buscemi movie to the end.
We've got a little bit of time. Have we got enough time to play the clip? Sure, well, Steve Buscemi's new movie, Interview, which is a remake of a film by Theo van Gogh, a Dutch filmmaker who was murdered.
He was on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Steve Buscemi was. Yes. And incidentally, Buscemi...
Yeah, well, clearly not Theo van Gogh, no.
No, but incidentally, Buscemi, not Buscemi. I asked him, I said, well, how do you pronounce it? And he said, Buscemi.
I know.
Oh, no, you were there.
It was live.
When he was on the show, I was there as well.
It was live on the radio at the time.
Fine, remake
when we had this long conversation about how to pronounce it.
Okay, political journalist has to interview a starlet. He hasn't done his homework. Here's a clip.
Katya.
The one and only.
What kind of a name is it?
It's a Russian name. Katya.
Are your parents Russian?
No, my mother is Dutch, and my father...
What city is she from?
Amsterdam.
Amsterdam, Sin City.
I've never been.
Oh, you should go. I've been many times.
Wow.
Legal prostitution.
Yeah.
And your father? I'm sorry.
Do you know anything about me at all? It's all right.
I mean, they sent me a brief, but...
You didn't read it? I mean, it's fine. You just don't seem to really...
Well, no, I'd rather...
get to know.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm sorry, I have not seen any of your films.
Oh.
I know you. I guess I know you more by your reputation.
It's an interesting idea. I have to say, in the end, it's far too stagey for its own good. There's something... I suppose quite brave about casting Sienna Miller as a potentially airheaded, you know, bimbo, who then, of course, in the course of the movie turns out not to be airheaded, and it's the political journalist who turns out to be the more devious of the two. I mean, I said the same thing about Factory Girl, that there is perhaps a correctness in casting her as Edie Sedgwick, who was basically just a walking clothes frog, and that was, you know, that in a way seemed like an intelligent piece of casting. I'm still not convinced by Sienna Miller, although she's clearly trying to do solid work as opposed to just entirely frivolous work. I think there may be more to be said about the idea of remaking a Theo van Gogh movie than the actual practicality of doing it. He has used several of Theo van Gogh's original crew, and that lends a certain degree of authenticity. But in the end, it is a stage play. That's what it looks like. I mean, I know it's not a stage film, but it looks like people in a room doing that thing that people in stage plays do. They laugh, they shout, they snog, they thing, they fall out, they do everything in a way that just doesn't happen in reality. So it's interesting, but I don't think it works, but it's an experiment.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live